Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And I gotta be honest, I am not feeling all of this snow in late May. How unbelievable is that? You know, I really wish that there was somewhere to put those emotions. Do you think that maybe part of the seasonal affective disorder is that you have all this anger and all of this sadness coming from nature, just nature itself? How do you get mad at that? How do you ground that? The only thing you can do is accept it. And I don't like that. I like to have more options, you know? I think everybody likes to have more options. I'm feeling a little nutty and a little boxed in, but thankfully, I'm not alone. I got you guys out there. And that brings me to this. I've been getting some emails lately, a lot more, as a matter of fact. But one in particular kind of stood out, and I reached out to the person and asked if I could read it on the air, and they said it was cool. So the subject line in this email said, TMI is life. And man, I really like that a lot. And the email says this. It says, "Hey there." Comes out strong. I like that. "Came across your podcast recently and am enjoying it. Very much up my alley. Well, thank you. I love talking mental health, as I've battled with ADHD, which was later diagnosed complex PTSD, your regular run-of-the-mill PTSD, and major depression since, oh, the first grade. No love or guidance from my parents left me floundering. Until I was 24, I was a victim of my circumstances. Homelessness, abuse, hell, even some boys I had just met got me in jail after they stole an Xbox. Seemed like the world was against me. All I had was art. I wrote a lot. Occasionally I'd make songs, rock and techno. And my main love was videography. I hit bottom so many times. I got so frustrated. I wanted to die. Honestly, I still do. But I know now that I don't actually want to go through with it. More so that I don't have the willpower to see it all the way through. So I was stuck. How do I keep struggling through this hell? I tried all sorts of things over the years. I really started to study my habits and reactions to things. Began forgiving myself. Seeing potential in myself, which allowed me to genuinely love someone else. Then I found my wife, who helped me flip my perspective on life. Everything began to dawn on me. Pursue film. So you only like doing music videos? Well, you can only make music videos if you want. Everything began stabilizing, and I was able to pursue my passions as a career. 2 years ago, I started up my own videography company. Granted, it's only me and my wife for now, but I'm fully immersing myself in what I wanted to do. Then, another huge wave of depression hit me. It was devastating to know that I had a wife, a home, a good job, was pursuing my passions, and still I felt horribly depressed. It lasted for months. I lost my job. I would bawl just imagining stepping outside the house. I couldn't even look at my phone. I just laid in bed and cried for seemingly no reason. One day I was tired of feeling that way, so I tried to turn to film. I decided to break my life down into a documentary, complete with family interviews and all. A lot of people thought it would be a bad thing for me to focus on, but the director's chair overcame any personal attachments I had. I was objective and fascinated by the fabrications, the missing memories, and inconsistent facts. I learned about patterns that ran through my family. I was learning what the cycle was so I could break it. But film wasn't enough. I decided to sit down and really think about everything a human needs to feel complete. I came up with a list and turned that list into a daily to-do. I broke down the days and figured out how much time I had and made time to fit everything in. I made timers for each activity I wanted to do, both on days I had to work and days I didn't. It took about 3 months to rearrange the house, to work with my messiness and fine-tune my daily ritual. It worked. It totally, 100% worked. But there is no permanent cure for negative emotions. You just have to take it as a sign and learn from it, then decompress. I've begun playing around and experimenting with rap, of all things. I've had lots of desires to jump into music lately. I'm finding that rap and hip-hop has been a great platform to let the writer and musician in me express the gunk in a way I never could. I've had a surprisingly positive response to it, although I'm cripplingly embarrassed of it. It was meant just to be my way to vent, but friends have been pushing me to do more with it. It's been playing on an internet radio station a lot, which is so exciting, surreal, but again, totally embarrassing. But anyway, I'm glad I'm here. Thoughts of escaping the pain of life never really seem to go away. But as you say, just going to start the day with a cup of coffee. Well, tea now, in my case. Thanks for listening. Yeah, I mean, come on, can you believe it? This is absolutely, absolutely crazy. This is absolutely wonderful. Go to cortex86d.com to check out what they're talking about. You know, I have a couple of points on this. You know what? I could cut out the throat clearing, but you know what? We're going to leave that in. Keeps things human, right? I have a couple of points on that. I can identify with that so hard. I, too, was a really young kid when I first discovered my dark passenger, my best friend, my buddy, my depression, my bipolar. You know, and it wasn't until I was older that I learned how to deal with it. And we actually kind of get into that a little bit in this episode. I, too, attempted a career in film. In fact, I got a couple of things under my belt, none of which I'm particularly good in, but I got a couple of things out there I'm proud to be a part of, regardless of how I feel about me. And I have a lot of music out there. You can actually find my music under the name Beast 4. I made an album and it sold like whatever the opposite of hotcakes are, but you know, I recorded and mixed and played and sang and wrote the entire thing all by myself. And honestly, it doesn't sound much better than the demo stage of a teenager. There's a lot of things that I know now that I really wish I could have done different. But the thing is, I'm glad that I've filled my time with trying to create something, using this frustration and this sadness as a tool to try to dig myself out, to try to solve the intellectual puzzle, to try to understand everything that I'm going through, to try to understand myself. You know, I did an hour of stand-up comedy that was deeply personal. And I look back on it and it's also deeply flawed. I was just working some things out. So it doesn't really matter if what you're doing now isn't your end result or isn't great. What matters is it's a thing that now exists in the world where before there was only an empty void. You did that. You made that. You filled the empty void with your voice saying, "I will not go quietly. You'll hear me. You'll know me." And I love you for that. Now, this week on the show, we have got Jeri Hinshaw, host of the Freak Train at the Bug Theater in Denver, Colorado. You may remember the Halloween episode that I did. That was recorded at the Freak Train. The Freak Train is wildly entertaining. It is kind of a kind of an open stage sort of thing. You pay $5 to get in. You get beer until the beer runs out. And you get a show. If you want to perform, you got to show up on time, 7 o'clock at night, and sign yourself up in one of the 12 slots on the list. And you have 5 minutes on stage to do whatever you want. That's it. That's all there is to it. There's been crazy stuff. I once saw a guy doing some kind of it seemed like a an electronic rock music duo with a ventriloquist dummy. That was really intense. I've gone up there and told stories. One time I read a children's book to a crowd of people. One time I saw a woman expressing a very deep, intense story about sexual assault. I mean, it's a show that runs the gamut, and it's an exercise in bravery. And if you want to check it out, join me. Let's be there this Monday. That's right, Memorial Day. Freak Train happens the last Monday of every month. And it's well worth your time. And the host is well worth your time as well. Let's talk to Jeri.
Doors are hard. People don't know how hard doors actually are.
God, that is I've cut and shaved and like done all, I mean when I first hung it, me and my podcasting partner, we built this room together with no knowledge of how to build a room.
Good.
So everything was just kind of like we shouldn't have done that. So now what?
Yeah.
So the whole room is that. And then we got it all completed and we couldn't believe it and we were so excited and we went to close the door and it was not anywhere near able to close. And
yeah, it's funny. I mean, doors are really hard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty excellent. I've been battling a strange allergy, but you know, it's making me cough. And
everyone is
weirdness. It's going around, right?
Yeah, under assault.
Yeah, I feel like there's some kind of crazy, you know, flesh-eating bacteria that's just in the air, just ready to kill us all.
Yeah, the pollen is out, like off the charts, from what I understand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Have you ever had like issues with allergies and stuff yourself?
I have really bad seasonal allergies.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it can, you know, get the whole like, you know, with the eyes, the itchy eyes, and then like the scratchy throat and like, you know, where you're like trying to scratch the back of it. but yeah, I finally figured out that starting like in early March, I have to take Claritin and Flonase every single day. And that's just it. And I do it. I just lay down that suppressive fire all the way through until July. And then I can stop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that you're cross-legged. I'm going to do that too. I'm going to match your energy. Because, I'm really feeling it right now. I can't believe I hadn't thought to do that before. This
it's
is very comfortable.
Right? It's nice. I'm actually just so short that I tend to
You
always,
just can't touch the floor anyway.
I can't touch the floor and my feet just kind of like hang there and it's not comfortable at all. So I'm always tucking my legs under.
Well, so let's tell me a little bit about you. So where do you come from? I mean, other than your parents.
I moved to Colorado in 1999 from Texas.
Oh, okay.
So I grew up in Texas, although I wasn't born there. I was born in Little Rock, Arkansas. My mom was in the Air Force, and she was stationed there.
Okay.
So
that makes sense.
So I did a little time in Little Rock.
Do you remember it?
I have little slivers of memory of our life there. This was before my mom and dad divorced. I have, and one of the memories, I'm not sure if it's a real one or if it's just one that's influenced by a photograph.
Yeah.
But the other one I know is real because there is no photograph of it. And it's, I have this memory of like, being on the floor on a blanket with, this little play drum, and I think my aunt was with me, and it feels like in the memory, it was like the middle of the night. And, you know, I think when I think on it now, it must have been that I'd woken up maybe in the middle of the night, and my aunt who was visiting, like, scooped me up and maybe took me out into the living room to, you know, just kind of play.
Yeah.
And let my parents sleep, which I now understand as a parent was such a gift.
Yes. Completely.
Yeah, but it was really dark. There was just some dim light. Yeah, it's a really cool memory. So that would have been, you know, somewhere between one and two.
Yeah. Wow. So from Arkansas to Texas. What part of Texas?
Fort Worth.
Nice.
The Fort Worth, Arlington area.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense.
Notice I don't say Dallas.
Yeah.
And it's not because I like hate Dallas. It's just that's not where I'm from.
Right.
And people will lump all of that into just the one Dallas area. And it's like, no.
Yeah,
nope.
Yeah.
I am from Fort Worth.
Yeah. It is different, though. I mean, when you're like even though I've only rolled through there a few times, like, you know, as a musician going through with bands and stuff, like, there's noticeably a difference.
Yeah, they're two very different cities, even though with all the sprawl, you know, just like with Denver now, Denver, Boulder,
yes.
Like, you can't really tell where, you know, Denver and then Westminster and then Broomfield and then, you know, Louisville all begin and end.
Yeah, but yeah. But Boulder has a decidedly different feel than Denver.
Yes, and no one would ever say, I'm from Denver if they grew up in Boulder or vice versa.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you come to Colorado in 99, and you just kind
of
stuck.
Just out of college.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
What'd you go to college for?
Well, I went to college because I thought that's what you're supposed to do. No, I'm just kidding. I actually had a couple of different majors, and I kind of took a smorgasbord approach to public universities.
So you didn't know what you wanted at all.
I totally knew what I wanted. I just kept changing the play on the field. So, like, I always had a pull between theater and music. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, right out of the gate, I had to choose between folks who wanted me to come and study theater or folks who wanted me to come and study music.
Well, just musical theater, I mean.
Right, but no, right? and so I started at UT and went with as a theater major.
Yeah.
And then midway through my freshman year, I didn't realize what was actually going on, but I thought I was losing my voice. And it turns out that what was happening is my voice was recovering from vocal abuse.
Yeah.
So I had been singing, like, in choir, I had been used very often to supplement the tenor section.
Yeah.
And then just sort of my whole life had been kind of self-taught in terms of singing, and that all combined to, like, really wear down my voice.
Yeah.
And when I wasn't singing all the time, my voice got to repair. But suddenly I felt like I didn't know this voice anymore. So I got really scared and I went and studied voice with the folks that, you know, initially were like, you know, my freshman year, like, come be with us, you know? So I left UT and went to Texas Tech and became a vocal music major. And then after a year in Lubbock, apologies to anyone in Lubbock. That was, and my whole family, all my family just sort of shook their heads as I headed out there. You know, even some family who actually went to school in Lubbock, yeah. You know, like love it and also knew Lubbock and Drury are not going to get along. So it was another year before I was like, nope. And yeah. I decided not to be a performance major at all. And, bumped my minor up to my major, and I have a bachelor's degree in French, Chris.
What? How did we get there?
I know. It was because I didn't want to stay in school any longer, and I also realized that I didn't need a performance degree to perform.
Right, of course.
So I knew that I didn't want to, like, pursue to a master's and become, you know, like, I didn't want to go to graduate school for performance.
Yeah.
That would be the reason to get a BFA.
Sure.
And like maybe be on a professorial track or to be just a, you know, a badass practitioner.
Yeah.
And that's just not what I wanted. I didn't want to continue pursuing my performance in academia. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's it. So
no, that doesn't make
I really
sense.
Just wanted the paper at that point.
My first thought process when I started going to college was, I'm going to study film.
Yeah.
And then it was like, I don't need that.
Right.
I can learn everything I need to learn for free.
Yeah.
By doing.
Yeah. And it's interesting, though, because I think that, I mean, obviously, there's so much to be gained from, you know, a really focused study of a field,
sure,
or a practice. But it is interesting that it has to also match like how you think and work and,
yeah,
you know, and sort of, you know, I think what you need. And I think at that point, what I needed was to not, you know, look at another, you know, at adding more time in school.
Yeah. So when did you first discover that you had the look at me gene?
Yeah, that was pretty early on. I mean, any of my family will say I've been a pretty big ham bone.
Just a hammy, hammy little kid.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, I've always wanted to sing. But what's interesting is I would get shy singing for my family.
Yeah.
I had a much easier time sort of showing out in front of strangers.
Yeah.
I wonder, do other people?
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Does that sound familiar?
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I can definitely speak to my own experience and the experience of the other people that I know, you know, the musicians and the actors that I've hung around with. It's always different in front of your family.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about that level of judgment or disappointment that
right.
you just don't want.
Yeah.
And I could really care less about what an audience thinks. I just want a reaction.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like a toddler in that regard. If I'm on stage, I want a reaction. And I'm not necessarily interested if it's a good one.
Yeah.
But I want I want something. I don't care if it's negative, just don't be indifferent to me.
Yeah. That's interesting because I have two sides to my family. You know, like, so my mom and my mom's side of the family, the Lopezes, and my dad's side of the family, my dad's side, it doesn't matter what you do, and I'm not saying that they don't have standards, but it doesn't
sure.
matter what you do. They're like, oh my gosh,
yeah.
that was so great. On the Lopez side, like, they love to be they're super supportive and loving. They're not effusive.
Yeah.
They're not like, they will laugh and have an amazing time, but if you do a thing, it'll be like, "Good job, mija." Like, yeah. that's it. You know,
yeah.
and like you don't know, like, did they like it? Did they not? What is that?
Right.
I think that's interesting that you say that, like, it's
yeah.
about the reaction.
Yes.
In some ways, I think it's so true, cuz, you know, like, you know, one side of my family, so, like I say, like, you never wonder, do they love you? But they're not.
But do they respect what
super,
you're doing?
Oh, they totally respect it.
Right.
But they're not, like,
Yeah.
They don't know necessarily how to, like, express, like, wow, you really moved me.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And the other side of my family, like, you know, it's like tears.
I mean,
it's
but
like,
was that a thing that manifested itself in other ways growing up?
Yeah, probably. I mean, my mom, she has always been able to, you know, be really, like, supportive and expressive of that, you know, gosh, Trey. And what's neat, too, is she'll come back, she'll circle back, she'll say, I was thinking about this thing. It'll be like 2 years later.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this. I can't believe you did that. I can't believe you. That's really amazing. Or, you know, even 10, 15 years later, she'll reflect on something and say, while everything was so fucked up.
Yeah, yeah.
And you managed to do that. Which is really cool. But for sure, like, you know, there were times, because again, divorced family, you know, all the standard stories of, like, difficulty with a stepdad, mm-hmm. Which we have overcome, and, you know, we're very much in a really, really great place as a relationship.
Yeah.
But it took a lot of time.
Well, how could it not? I mean, how old were you when he entered the picture?
I was 5 when they started dating, but, mm-hmm. I was 11 or 12 when they got married and when we moved in.
That's a good age to...
Right? It's perfect. I mean, you're just so, like...
You're so open to the world.
There's nothing awkward about anything. And yeah, and, you know, I think that he would say, you know, he had some regimented notions of you know, kids... And what you could expect of them.
Sure.
And that wasn't the kind of kid I was.
Did he bring any kids to the table? Or
yeah. So my stepbrother is 2 years younger than me. But my stepbrother lived with his mom.
Okay.
So, you know, every other weekend, you know, we'd get to see one another.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was the kid suddenly in his home.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think what was neat is that, you know, the very like, I don't know, but both sides of the family were always a really constant source of love. But I could confide in what was scary about what I was going through more with my dad's side of the family, which stands to reason since it would have been about my mom's sort of choice in marriage.
Sure.
But they never were like, well, he's just awful, you know?
Yeah.
Like, which is kind of remarkable.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they would.
At least not to you. I mean, they had to know better, you know?
Well, yeah. And of course, you know, if your precious niece or your precious kid, if you feel like there's a person who's mean and not listening and being terrible, you know, I mean, But I just always felt like I had a safety net.
Yeah.
In that way.
So your family was close.
Very close.
That's good.
Yeah. And, you know, in the end, everyone got it figured out. Like, people can speak to one another in ways that they weren't able to do before. You know, it's been good. At my wedding, which was... it'll be 14 years ago this November. My stepdad, I had him, I asked him to walk me down halfway.
Yeah.
And then, he and my dad shaked hands. And then my dad took me the rest of the way down
the
aisle.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. It was really neat. And all of the different cousins from all these different sides, like, all had different roles in the wedding and stuff. And it was cool. I mean, I think that family is hard,
yeah.
You know, and especially when there's the expectation that, you know, like, everyone, you know, you've got you're looking after this kid or these kids. And now as a parent, I realize how every single moment you think, this is where I fuck them up for the rest of their lives. Yeah. And, you know, you think...
It's never the one you think it is, though.
Right. Totally. But, like, you know, just the constant, you know, and everything changes just the minute you think that, okay, I think we've got this down now, you know, and something shifts. And, you know, when you're managing, you know, that many different feelings, you know, everybody's bringing their different, you know, approaches to handling life. Like, I don't know, having a close family is really special and can also be really hard.
Yeah. And what ways is that hard? Can it be restrictive?
Yeah, it's restrictive. I don't know. I think it's more that you just want things to be good for everyone. And it's never true all the time.
Because you've got a wide bubble
of
people that you care about.
Yes.
And, you know, whereas, I completely get it. It's the opposite of restrictive.
Right.
It's way too inclusive sometimes.
Right.
There's too many people to care about.
Right. And you know, and everyone matters.
Yeah.
And you know, then it's interesting because it's like, well, didn't we all agree this is how we do things?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, especially when, you know, siblings start to marry and then they, you know, that, you know, now they have a different sort of perimeter of their family. And so it's interesting, too, because, you know, that changes dynamics. And, you know, it's not just any longer about, you know, how we were all comfortable with something.
Yeah.
Now it's like, well, but that doesn't work for this spouse, like, at all.
Yeah.
And so now what? Because it's not that spouse is, like, a shit person.
Right.
You know, like,
but they just
have
more
other needs, too.
Yeah.
Right? So it's interesting. Yeah.
So, I mean, with that much positivity in your upbringing and with everything that you've had to do, how'd you still end up so weird?
Well, first of all, who says I'm weird? Weird. I think, you know, I think probably because I feel like I can see a full spectrum.
Yeah.
And I think...
Well, you're an artist type.
Sure. And I think also, like, you know, again, to go back to my stepdad, I mean, he was, you know, what's interesting is, you know, for the longest time, I thought that my stepdad was the only depressed person I'd ever known.
Yeah.
And he had, you know, and I guess probably technically has clinical depression. Mm-hmm. Or bipolarity. Now I'm kind of fuzzy
those,
on
those
the,
two
on the,
can be tough,
they can sort of go back and forth in terms of where the practitioners kind of lay it. And mm-hmm. you know, I don't, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I don't want to, like, put, you know, his medical history on the podcast, but, like,
yeah.
my point is that, you know, I've, you know, his, what he was struggling with, and especially before he had gotten help with it, was a force of destruction emotionally for me. And, I had never, even though, you know, I'd already been a kid of divorce, mm-hmm. I had never, questioned whether I was lovable mm-hmm. until being subjected to that disease.
Yeah.
And and then, so there were all the struggles therein. Then my sister, who's 8.5 years younger than me, and she and I share the same dad.
Okay.
So I had my mom and my stepdad in one household, and then I had my dad and my stepmom in another.
Yeah.
Okay. And so my sister from my dad and my stepmom, she one day let me know that she was having trouble with my dad, whom I had never had. Like, my dad was awesomeness and love and,
yeah,
and like super there for me. Like, it was unbelievable to me but I also, my sister, like, I knew this person, and she was a child of 14 at that point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had seen him be sort of verbally rough with her, and had, you know, it had sort of been like kind of couched under like, she's a Scorpio.
Okay.
You know, like, yeah. Oh, and she's feisty, and, you know, wow, you know, I never had to fight with you about certain things, but boy, she is a teenager. She's really hard, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, cool, you know, 'cause not every parent and kid like combo goes beautifully, right?
Right. Yeah. That's the thing they don't tell you is that, you know, it's not always going to work out great.
No. Like, there are fits and not yeah. fits. And what's interesting is, you know, your phases of life can be, you know, like, you may not be the pairing for the teens, but it'll be interesting what happens later in life with,
yes.
with those same two, you know?
Completely.
Totally. But all, you know, like, it was then that I realized that, you know, everybody has, you know, these different demons that they wrestle with. Mm-hmm. And everyone can be brought to their knees by, like, depression. Mm-hmm. You know, my dad lost his dad when he was a teenager. And, you know, there are things that I can see now clearly with hindsight.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, like, what that really did, how that really broke him in a lot
yeah.
of ways. And it turned out that the combo that my dad and my sister came to things with were, like, pretty flammable.
Yeah.
But he was the adult. You know, he was the one that should have, you know, in the same way that the, you know, that my stepdad, being the adult, was the one who really should have been able to kind of be the one to find the help. Which,
yeah.
Which he actually did seek help.
What was that? Was that a thing that was particularly challenging? Because it is, especially, I can say from my perspective, in the age in which I grew up, you know, it was like it was just kind of coming around the corner to the point where people were sort of over it.
Mm-hmm.
And like, oh, geez, everybody's got to shrink these
oh,
days,
right,
you know?
Right.
It, like, in the early 90s.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
it was like, everybody, it had become kind of, it had gone over the hump of acceptable uh-huh. into annoying.
Uh-huh.
And so society was kind of like, oh, everybody's got a problem now. Of
yeah.
course you do. But up to that point, there was still all of that stigma that
yeah.
came along with it. And
right.
especially for, you know, a masculine person.
Yes.
And when you hit that area of fatherhood, even though society had changed as much as it had.
Yeah.
Once I became a dad.
Yeah.
I thought about it a little differently.
Yeah.
You know, I worried about it differently. And mm-hmm. I worried about how much do I share with my kids? How much, you know, how much am I supposed to just be strong and deal with this on my own?
Right.
And
how much is too much for them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do they need to know that, you know, that dad is in the bedroom crying because he can't face the world?
Right.
You know, do
right.
they need to know that at five, or do they need their Fruit Loops?
Right. Exactly.
They might need some version of both of those things.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, because I think, you know, so like, So back to the stigma.
Yes.
So, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, my stepdad, who went into therapy, mm-hmm. We all went into therapy, actually, as a family, my mom, my stepdad, and me.
Oh,
and,
wow. Family therapy.
Uh-huh. And very soon.
Yeah.
The family therapist was like, okay. It was basically like, Dree and mom, you can go now. And there was a period where I think that my stepdad kind of pushed against that for a second. Like, wait a second, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't there any responsibility? I mean, think of all her commitments, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, literally the family therapist was like, you know, a commitment is something that an adult has. You know, when we get married, that's a commitment. When we have a child, that's a commitment. 11-year-olds don't usually have commitments to dishes. That's just a chore.
Yeah.
And so there, you know, I remember hearing those words and thinking, I feel like things might be okay. You know, that this starts to feel like someone's starting to right-size the world again to me.
Yeah.
And for a second, he was very resistant to it, and my heart sank all over again.
Wow, of course.
But then, you know, eventually he was doing the work, and I didn't necessarily see all of that, and we still had hard times. But by the time I got into college, and I had a really tough year in Lubbock, when I came back, I stayed with my parents and went to school locally, and he sat down one day and he legitimately apologized. And when I say apologized for everything, I mean he apologized for everything. And he said, when I hear what you've been going through, I think how upset I am about these people who've hurt your feelings, who've taken advantage of you. And then I think about what I put you through.
Yeah.
And I just realize how much I want to tell you that I'm sorry and thank you for being, you know, so strong and loving and just always coming back to the table.
You know?
And that meant everything.
Yeah.
And you never get one of those. Do you know what I mean?
Well, there's an incredible strength required to be able to be that vulnerable.
Huge.
With another human being and actually, you know, look them in the eye and tell them, I get it.
I know what it wasn't you.
Yeah.
It really was me.
I know where I was, and guess what? I fixed a bunch of things, and now I see these holes that I put in the walls, and I'm just trying to patch them back up. And I want you to know I know what that was like, and I'm sorry you had to go through that.
Everything.
I mean, that's huge.
Yeah. And I mean, it's so interesting that there are so many things that he modeled that I had to like push away as much as I could because it was like, not that, not that, not that. Yeah. And in that moment, it was like, holy cow. Like, you know, like I have had moments since where I've thought, hey, it's time. It's time for you to like step up to the plate.
Sure.
You know? It's so yeah.
But having a manic depressive person, you know, as a caregiver in the house can be incredibly tumultuous.
Oh God!
Because you don't necessarily know which version of the person you're getting.
Yep.
Because it can change.
It can change
without an obvious reason.
And you, when you're a person like I'm built. Mm-hmm. What you do first is you think to yourself pretty much right away two things. One, what did I do? And then two, how could I not do it like that next time? So you constantly think.
You start building defenses.
You're just going to analyze how we got here.
Yeah.
You're going to see your sort of footpath in that thing and you're going to do a dip. You're going to handle this differently next time so that we don't end up like this. And it's never...
Yeah.
It took me actually marrying someone with clinical depression. Yay! I love him and I adore him. But it took journeying through that and finally one day getting to the place, and I still have to talk myself through it.
Yeah.
But like... where you're standing there and just this, the hot heat of this anger and sort of irrational rage is burning up the air around you, and you just kind kind of imagine your little bubble and you just take a breath because you can.
Yeah.
You can still breathe. There is nothing you've done.
Yeah.
It is okay. This will pass. There may be something to discuss here.
Yeah.
But it isn't your fault.
Right.
You are not a terrible person who has once again triggered this anger.
Yeah. Irrational rage is the perfect way to phrase that.
Yeah. And it's so tough because, you know, I mean, our emotions and the way we express them, like, that's a communication. Like,
yeah.
You know, we use expression of our emotions as a form of communication.
Sure.
And so you kind of got to ninja your way through that sometimes to, like, realize right now, this isn't communication to me.
Yeah.
And so I have to, like, kind of turn off my little receiver right now. This is not information for me.
Right. Yes.
And it's hard, but I've gotten better and better at it. But when you're young.
Yeah.
You don't know fucking anything about that. You don't know how to, you don't know how to do that. All right. You know is like, because I was a total pleaser. Like, okay.
Yes.
Gauntlet thrown. How can we not have this happen again?
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, my father was an alcoholic and decided to clean it up, you know, when I was little.
Mm-hmm.
And, but we haven't really talked about it at great length, mm-hmm. because it's been most of my life he's been sober guy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
But what's so fascinating about that to me is being able to look back on certain things from childhood and go, oh, Dad was a dry drunk for a few years.
Oh, wow.
Like, he was really angry and just
gutting it out.
Yeah,
before gritting his teeth.
He really decided to do it for real.
Yeah,
like in his heart.
Yeah, yeah.
He was doing it without drinking.
Right,
he was pissed about it. Yeah, he was. In fact, the one clue that I had about that, because I remember my dad being quiet, but like he was an energy.
Mm-hmm.
Like he'd come into a room and you knew it.
He could shift the air.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, he was so huge in the house and silent.
Mm.
He rarely said a word.
Oh, God.
And the funny thing about that is years later, you know, looking at this guy now, totally, you know, like he's just the sweetest, smartest, you know, he's a great dude.
Mm-hmm.
But he grew his beard. He's had a beard my whole life, other than some, you know, photos where he was doing his Tom Selleck giant mustache thing from the 70s when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
He grew a beard, but he grew a beard in the hospital because part of drying out required him to shave, and he was like, fuck you.
Nice.
So he grew a beard to say, fuck you.
That was his middle finger.
And he kept it to remind himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while, I'll remember that
mm-hmm.
when I see him now
mm-hmm.
with his gray beard and go, this guy was that guy.
Yeah.
That's so weird.
That's cool.
The way that people adjust and grow. And
isn't it interesting, too, because you count on both stories.
Yes.
So you count on the story that is, you know, people just are who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't change them.
Yeah.
And you also count on the stories where people totally make decisions to change.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, you know, obviously they don't change who they are.
Right.
But they change the decisions that they make. You know, they change what they focus on as the goal, you know, but it's a trajectory change that comes from new ways of making decisions is sweeping. It's incredible to watch somebody like, you know, rise from their own ashes, you know, it's it's so inspiring. And I think sometimes we think falsely that that's only certain people capable of doing something like that.
Yeah. I mean, the easiest way to think of yourself as capable is to take a look at any given situation that you're facing and phrase it to yourself in such a way where you say, this is what's happening, and now who am I going to show up as?
Yeah.
And once you start realizing that you have some ownership over how you react to things that you have you don't have control over everything that comes at you, but you do have control over what you're going to do when it hits you.
Yes.
But that's a tough thing to get your head around when you're so used to just reacting in the moment.
It is. And, you know, like my 3, then 4, then 5-year-old is who kind of taught me that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I started to realize when I get mad at him and I let him see how mad I've gotten, regardless of the value of, you know, whether it was I was mad because he ran out into the street, which is like total righteous anger, right. a person would think, right?
Of course,
like,
yeah.
Although if you really back it up, like what purpose did the anger serve at all in the lesson, right?
Yeah.
None.
I mean, you can't overthink everything.
Sure.
But okay,
right.
Yes.
Yeah. Or I said, it's nap time.
Yeah.
And you're really pissing me off that you're not going to fucking sleep. Right? Okay.
Yeah.
So, like, when you realize every time I got mad, or, you know, he, quote unquote, made me mad.
Yes.
It's like every time there was a moment I can put my finger on it when I let myself be mad.
Yeah.
There was a moment when I made a decision to show him how mad I am.
Yeah.
And once I realized that, you know, because I started to, because of course, it's me. I started going, is that true? You know, and like I would really think through the, like some like in my mind, some of the seminal anger points, you know, like, and I was like, yep. There was that flash moment right there. There was the flash moment right there. I was in total control of deciding a different thing. And I was just not.
Yeah.
And over time, and I'm not perfect at it, but, you know, when you kind of almost make a little physical challenge for yourself.
Yeah.
And you build the breath into it, you know, like, buddy, and you like the next word is just not a shitty word, you know, just not between your gritted teeth.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like it's just everything, because then things just sort of kind of roll downhill from that choice, you know, instead of, you know, like pouring fuel on this flame, you know.
Right.
And it's really interesting how you do realize, like, you think that you've been made to feel a certain way, and really you've chosen.
Right.
Ugh.
You get to pick that.
Yeah, you do, which is crazy.
There's levels of anger within yourself that you have to learn how to express properly as a human being. Anger is an emotion you're going to experience at some point in your life, and there is not a single person who hasn't experienced and had to express anger. And if you don't express it correctly, and if you choose to tamp it down and hold it in and ignore it, it's going to come out somewhere.
Right.
And probably not at the right place.
Right. Yeah. Right. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because, you know, there's anger that I think is there's got to be some pure anger. But I think also most of the time, it's not actually anger.
Right.
It's fear.
Oh, yeah.
It's shame.
Yes.
It's, you know, these other things that, you know, it's like, and usually when it's the way I feel about my son's behavior, it's almost always fear or shame.
Yeah.
And it's like, that is not his, so that is just not for him.
Yeah.
So again, like information that he really doesn't need from you. Like, right. And, you know, I can think of these moments where I have, you know, ostensibly been, you know, coaching him, you know, or, you know, are you kidding me? You know, I remember one time he climbed up, like we're standing in this little cabin that some friends of ours rented, and you know, in my mind, like, it's like, you know, we treat things with care. This is not our place. This is not where we live. This is, you know, we don't just like crawl on the back of the goddamn sofa.
Right.
Just like it's a fucking jungle gym. What the fuck? You know, yeah. And like, I look up, I'm having a conversation with my friend, and then suddenly I hear, "Mom," and I look up, and he is standing on the back of a chair, like, you know, like full on. And in that moment, the only thing that was real, that like was like bossing around the rest of my emotions, was total shame.
Yeah.
Which the crazy part is, the friends I was with, not the kind of people to make you feel ashamed.
Right.
Not the kind of people to judge in any way.
Right, but it's not about them.
So not. And it's so crazy. It's like when you realize just where those things just get internalized, and it's like it doesn't matter how safe you are feeling in the moment.
Yeah.
You can get ripped right back to some little place where you feel like, I overlooked something. I should have said, I was not on call. Oh, oop, I let something slip through.
Yeah.
It's just this like, oh my God. And then that moment I looked at him, I go, are you kidding me? And I mean, I had a look on my face as if he had, you know, slapped everyone's faces and like kicked them in the nuts, you
right.
know,
yeah.
Like all he was doing was standing on the top of a chair, you know, yeah. What I mean? On the back of a sofa.
But it wasn't even about him. It was about you.
No, it was not about him. But when I think about the face I gave him, and the words I used,
yeah.
Like, it's just, it makes me want to crawl into a hole and die.
Right.
Anyway, shame.
But looking at all of those things and being so self-aware about your relationship with shame, your relationship with anger, your relationship with the language that we use with each other, and not only as a parent, but as a human being out in the world, you've had it modeled for you by your stepdad and your mom, and the recognition of there are healthy ways to do this, mm-hmm. and not, and if you're struggling with something, you get some help,
mm-hmm.
and so having that sort of supportive network in your life, mm-hmm. and that kind of positive mentoring, mm-hmm. in a way, mm-hmm. has to have manifested itself. But where else did you get this level of awareness? I mean, did you ever go and seek therapy on your own for anything?
Recently, you know, I think everyone should just like get proposed to or propose, and then like immediately go sign up for couples counseling. But yeah, so like, you know, after the short period of time that I was in family counseling when I was younger,
yeah,
the next time I had any therapy was actually after some friends of ours lost their son when he killed himself,
mm-hmm.
and we were, you know, as this small community around this family,
yeah,
all just dropped off a cliff. Like, it just felt like, beyond uncharted territory. It was,
yeah,
we were floating in space. Like, there was, it was so.
No one can prepare you for the void of a suicide.
It is.
Because it's not just a death, it's so much instant questions, terror
that are unanswerable.
No answers.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And we want to bring comfort, and there's none to be had.
Yeah.
And if you're real good, if you're good at being a friend, quote unquote.
Yeah.
In that particular scenario, you walk this like tightrope of like being there, but not thinking that you're doing any good.
Yeah.
And not needing them to appreciate anything.
Yeah.
And it's, and, you know, so you're, you, and I mean, I cannot imagine a, like, better people to have had to traverse that impossible time and space with. And all of that being said, it did a number on me, just like anyone.
Yeah.
And I began to have these, I would have these visions of death of my own child every time I would close my eyes. And I thought, well, that's weird.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, okay, that it's probably just because it's really intense right now. And then it kind of continued and kept going. And then I thought, okay, I think maybe I need to see someone. And so that actually took me into personal therapy.
Yeah.
So at that point, you know, my husband and I, we had done couples counseling before that, but I had never had like a personal therapist.
Right. Yeah. Because I mean, you grew up around, clinical depression and seeing that manifest itself in people around you, but you yourself didn't have that.
No, I'd never, you know, I had postpartum depression, mm-hmm. Back in, so like 2012 through 2013.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was happening at the time.
Sure.
I can look back on it and know, oh my God, without any question in my mind, you know, and I can talk, you know, ad nauseum about how I wish that beyond being just asked the pat questions you're supposed to be asked in your postpartum appointments, that they would really take time to dig. And, you know, I think almost anyone who's saying they seem to feel okay, like, I think there's still some digging you should probably do, because a lot of women are really good at making it fine.
Yes.
And but
completely, because you have a job to do.
A job to do, and what you know is, of course, this is hard.
Yeah.
And don't look at me. I'm not asking you for special treatment, because I know this is hard. Moms do it all the time. I can't imagine a mom who does it with two already. I can't imagine a mom who does it with one leg. I can't imagine a mom who does it and she's single. I can't imagine a mom who does it and she's got two jobs. All you do is you just try to think of all the ways that someone probably has it 10,000 times worse than you, and they're probably fine.
Right.
And you have no right to, like...
Yes. Yeah. And you think all of that, and you don't even realize that you're causing yourself damage by denying your trauma.
Yes. Yes. But you know, it's like you just go, God, of all the things in the world, like, I tried and tried to have a child. We finally have one. And I'm going to say I'm depressed?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? Like, so there was that journey where I wished that I had actually, you know, kind of pulled the help cord.
Yeah.
And so on this one, where, you know, it was just these visions that kept coming to me. I mean, literally, I would just lay down, I'd close my eyes, and scenes of my son's death in many different ways would just start flashing like a movie you couldn't stop watching.
Yeah.
And so that was my first time going into personal therapy. And what that person was able to point out for me, it was, hey, you know, it's interesting, because not that the things you all are going through and watching your friends have to hold up and handle and, you know, do the impossible is not, it's not that that's not hard.
Yeah.
But I'm also noticing these other things that you've talked about, there's been a lot of change for you. And she started to piece together all these different seemingly minor changes in our lives that had happened, including like moving and having a new position at work and, you know, things that just you feel like are mundane and also like, you know, that's just life, right?
Yeah.
And she was able to help me see that, you know, you're a creature who has habits for success, and none of those are possible right now. Your everything about your life has changed almost 100% in a year's time.
Yeah.
And this happened.
Yeah.
And so it was really revelatory to understand that as much as we think we're these, you know, like we have these big, big thoughts and we're, you know, we're these big thinking creatures and we lead these complex emotional lives. Also, we're a body.
Yes.
And a nervous system. And, you know, like we undergo even the most mundane ways that change. Mm-hmm. Like assaults our senses.
Yes.
You know, you're making
a change in the barometer.
You're making decisions on how to get to work that you've mm-hmm. that you haven't before, because she's like, do you know how you like to get to work? And I was like, no, not yet. I've been trying to, and you know, she was like, you know, it's little, but it can be everything. It's
yeah.
like you still don't know your new routine.
Yes.
So it was just interesting to, like, because you think all of, you know, when I lay down and I close my eyes and I see the death of my son in a myriad ways.
Yes.
You think it's all because of this other huge existential terrible tragedy. And it's like, it's some of that.
Yes.
But your whole body is in complete, like, trauma right now.
Yes.
And it's not all the high emotional stuff you're thinking about.
Well, and the thing about that too, that I'm so glad that you brought that up, because there is in people who are diagnosed with a depressive disorder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take my bipolar, please.
no, thank you.
Yeah. It's if you take a look at something like that as an example, it's a tweak mm-hmm. on reality. That is, in essence, what it does to make itself known
mm-hmm.
and apparent.
Mm-hmm.
It comes in and it just throws a coat of paint over reality,
mm-hmm.
and now it's a different color, it's a different texture, it's a different shape. It feels differently. And even if you can't quite put your finger on why, you react to it. Your body has a way of starting to, you know, put the walls up and start saying, we're defending ourselves against something.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have a number of changes that are coming at you from multiple different directions, even if they're positive changes,
right.
even if they're overwhelmingly positive changes, you can be struck by these changes in such a way that your body is suddenly saying, different.
Yeah.
React. And it can throw a little bit of chaos into something that should be positive,
mm-hmm.
or even something that is ultimately negative.
Mm-hmm.
It can throw you into chaos,
yeah.
both mentally and physically, because you're now in a place where your ape brain is in place going, danger.
Yes.
Difference is danger.
Yes, on guard.
Yeah, exactly. And that'll fuck up your whole reality.
Yeah.
So even if you're a person who's not affected by, say, you know, a random hijack
yeah.
kind of depression.
Yeah.
You can be made to suffer a PTSD of sorts
mm-hmm.
by having an overabundance of stimulus hit you at a time when you're not ready for it.
Yeah.
And that can be really overwhelming.
Yeah. And, you know, you can have that slow, you know, that whole frog in water
yeah.
analogy, you know. So,
yep.
like, of course, you drop the frog in hot water, they're going to jump out. But if you've turned that heat up really slowly, all of a sudden, you know,
deal with this.
Over time,
yeah.
you know, they're in boiling water,
yeah.
you know. And I think that year had for sure been an example of that. It's just one change that you wanted after another.
Yeah.
Setting the stage for then this complete just nuclear explosion of terribleness and
yeah.
pain.
Chaos.
And, yeah. And then that was it. Like, you know, I had no more control anymore of what sort of scenes of destruction my brain wanted to just kind of like play out.
Do you think you ever fully recovered up to that point from the postpartum? Or was that still lingering?
You know, it's interesting because it happened. So my son was born March 2012, mm-hmm. and this happened in early summer 2013. So
okay, so you
technically,
were probably...
I was still in that. I think you know, I was definitely coming out of the what I think was the sheer depression there.
Yeah.
But I was again. By virtue of all the other changes that were going on.
Yeah, maybe still a little raw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot for anyone to go through.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't imagine carrying
Not to
a
mention
child.
That, again, you go, you think to yourself, what right have I to be having any problems whatsoever?
Yeah. Yep.
And... You know, and honestly, if it hadn't manifested itself in what was clearly starting to seem like a little cuckoo to me, with you know, like I've never had trouble going to sleep. Like that's just not an issue I have. Mm-hmm. I lay down, I take some breaths, I close my eyes, I fall asleep. I know what a gift that is. Suddenly, that was not happening, and what was happening instead was this. I could not stop my brain from doing this.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, this is clearly not right. And had there not been something that was so acute, I don't know that I would have gone for any therapy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I would have talked myself once again out of having the right to be a mess.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, children... It's such a tough thing to explain to anybody. You know, I can honestly say, and you know, my kids are very aware of what I'm doing with the podcast and everything. Mm-hmm. So
how old are they?
My kids are now, this is hilarious. They are 19
uh-huh.
and 16.
Okay.
And so, yeah.
Yeah. They are fully comprehending.
Completely. Uh-huh. And I have a much better relationship with them now, than I ever did when they were small. Mm-hmm. Because when they were small, Dad was in his own head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and then their mother and I got divorced, mm-hmm. and I became weekend dad.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a different dad.
Right.
Than before. And, you know, I'd always gone through my life trying to figure out which, you know, how to get myself mentally well,
mm-hmm.
because from a very, very young age, I was aware something was off,
mm-hmm.
and I was diagnosed pretty young.
Oh, okay.
And so it was pretty clear to me that I had a responsibility. And then once the first kid showed up, it was like, oh shit, I'm someone's dad. I have a real responsibility to start trying to figure this out.
Isn't that interesting? It's like you knew academically.
Yeah.
But it's not until the arrival.
Oh man.
Total human being.
You know, I tend to do this a lot, and I think a lot of other people do, where, you know, you feel like by intellectually understanding something,
yes.
that once you intellectually understand it, the Rubik's Cube is solved and the problem should go away.
Totally.
And it just does not work that
way. Nope, not ever.
Yeah, completely. My biggest worry at all was, you know, I'm going to pass this mental illness on to my kids. They're going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, thank God I'm in a better place to deal with it than my parents were.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of hit them out of left field that I was weird.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they didn't really know what to do with it
because
my parents are, you know, pretty conservative, country music kind of like nice people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I saw skateboards and punk rock and I was like, bye.
But you know, real country music is totally punk rock.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Like,
oh yeah, but they weren't into that.
But not that country music. Okay.
You know, I think growing up, my mom had one record album in the house and it was the soundtrack to Cats. And so, you know, You know, and then I see the Sex Pistols on TV and I'm like, I'm going to be
my
over
people.
Here. Yeah, exactly. And they're just like, this is disgusting. I'm like, yeah, but it's also really compelling, right? Like, you know, I bring home the Ramones and they're just like, I don't get it.
Right, right.
You know, and I'm like, I can't, I don't know what to tell you. I'll see you later. You know, and then theater and everything, they were always trying to be supportive, but they never got it.
Right.
They were like, yeah, okay. I don't get it.
Right. And so do you feel like now, I mean, at their ages, 16 and 19, do you feel like they have a more accessible father than they've had before?
They ever have, yeah. Yeah. I mean, because it got a little dicey after the divorce. I opened up as a father, like it was because it was suddenly like you can't be in your own head anymore. Mm-hmm. You can't because here's the thing. Like I would worry about whether or not I was interacting with my children properly.
Right.
To the point where I was spending my time doing that mm-hmm. and watching them play.
Right. Yeah.
Versus playing with them.
Just getting up in there.
Yeah. And so luckily they were pretty little. You know, I think they were like 5, 6 mm-hmm. years old.
When you divorced?
So, yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, they went through the tough patch on that, mm-hmm. You know, where, you know, behavior and things and of course and
all like, the stuff
I get it.
Where kids are like, you know what?
Yeah.
I don't know what the fuck you guys did, but this is some fucked up shit.
Yes. Yeah. So, you
and
know,
I'm going to show you how fucked up it is.
Yep. So I fucked my kids up for a while and then, you know, kind of got them through it. And then, you know, I'm not telling any tales that haven't been approved, I guess we'll say, but, you know, so my one son, it turned out he got something from me and my other didn't. And so it was just kind of like, okay, mm-hmm. well, I mean, it's so you're becoming different people mm-hmm. and that's okay. But I mean, they're so close. They love each other so much and they're like best friends. But you know, my one son, he got a little of the something.
So if that was your worst fear.
And it was, and it terrified me mm-hmm. when it started to manifest, mm-hmm. like, oh, there's something going on here, mm-hmm. something beyond just teenage shit. Mm-hmm. I was ready, and I was capable, and it was like,
okay,
let's handle
it.
Yeah, I got this. I've been training my whole life to be able to help somebody.
That's awesome.
And here you are, and I got you. Dad's here.
Yeah.
And
because, you know, it's not from you.
Right. Correct. Yeah. It's not. And I found out, too, you know, my dad, he told me probably just a year or two ago, you know, he sat down and just for a moment I got... It came out very strange, and I did not want it. I didn't like it. But he was just like, you know, I think back on you know, the alcoholic days, and I know you were little, but I'm so sorry you kids had to go through that.
Aww.
And he was like, you know, I'm so ashamed of that. And ugh. And it was like, I don't want that.
Right. Right. You're like, hold on. I've been good. I'm good. So
I'm solid. Like,
interesting.
You did okay, but I don't want this. I don't want vulnerable dad.
Wow.
And I realized, oh yeah. Yeah. I think that I've been avoiding saying these same kind of things. Mm-hmm. Like, and so I talked to my kids mm-hmm. and especially when I started doing this podcast, it was like, by the way, Dad's going all out there. Mm-hmm. Everybody's going to know everything. Are you okay with this? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, I need you to be able to make peace with it.
And they may change their answer.
And they might. And that's fine. But, I mean, ultimately, they've been really good about it. And
that's they're, cool.
I mean, my one son is like, I don't care. Mm-hmm. You know, and the other one is like, I'm really proud of you. And I think it's great that you're, you know, trying to let people know that, you know, there's life after Strange.
Yeah.
There's life with Strange. You can live with it and go through it and, you know, all of that. And I was like, and I had an episode that I sat on for a while because I was sitting across from somebody, you know, and, you know, we're just pulling our guts out in front of each other and, you know, it's awesome and we're having a good time. And I don't know what happened, but I felt comfortable and in a way that I hadn't mm-hmm. with a previous guest. Mm-hmm. And I started talking about my sexual assault.
Oh.
And it came out and I was like, and God bless her. She just sat there and she listened
mm-hmm.
and we talked and, you know, had a couple of, you know, macabre laughs about various things.
Well, gallows like humor. Do.
Yeah. And it came out and then the episode was done and I edited it mm-hmm. and, you know, well, as insofar as I edit, you know, intro, outro.
Yeah.
And then I didn't release it the next week
mm-hmm.
or the next week
mm-hmm.
or the next week.
Right.
And then it was like, and then I had to go and I had to go and I took, and I told my son, I was like, so, I know you're not listening to the show anymore, but you should be aware. This is coming out.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be out in the universe. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, wow, are you okay?
Mm-hmm.
You're asking me if I'm okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm fine.
Right.
I'm good. Actually. I feel really good about this.
Yeah.
I'm glad that this is going out in the world because I realized I have never really talked about it. He was like, okay, good. Yeah, as long as you're okay.
Yeah.
I'm okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you know what you're doing. Thanks, kid.
Yeah,
that's you know, awesome. It's weird. It's weird they're turning into adults.
You realized I'm about to lay down a truth that, like, forget whether or not I'm okay letting the world know about it.
Yeah.
I'm about to lay down a truth that my kids are old enough that that sort of revelation about their father.
Yeah.
Before they've even come to know that about me.
Yeah.
And also, like what responsibility do
first.
I have as a dad to be able to let these, you know, almost grown up kids,
yeah,
you know that it's possible for this to have happened to a father.
Yes.
And, you know, that it, you know, it's like...
Bingo.
Yeah.
And that, I guess that was kind of the whole point about, like, bringing up, you know, my dad talking about his damage. And me realizing, oh, yeah, I have a hard time hearing that
mm-hmm.
because, you know, he's not a person.
Mm-hmm.
He's dad.
Right.
You know, just like to them, in my head, I feel like, you know, I feel like I'm a person who's gone through some things and come out the other side and lived a life and made
right.
mistakes. And,
yeah.
You know, but I mean, to them, you know, I'm dad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm bad jokes and horrible socks and you know just
right.
embarrassing
right.
And so now here comes this thing that could also be embarrassing depending on what kind of people they are
right.
You know, do they want it out in the universe that you know that their dad went through something like this
right.
And ultimately, like, I was really glad. It's like, okay, because I mean ultimately there are certain decisions where I've just got to decide I'm going to make peace with it
mm-hmm.
and you know, we're going to have to agree to disagree, but.
Well, yeah, but I mean, but I think in that case, like they're, you know, clearly what mattered to them is whether you're cool with
yeah.
it. And I think that that's most of the time really what kids need from their parents.
Yeah.
You know, like, there was a point we went to therapy for our son who was having some struggles with his own way of expressing himself, and he would sometimes hit kids.
Yeah.
And we were just kind of like, is this cool? Like growing up, or is there something else that we need to be aware of? You know. And that therapist was like, yeah, this kid's fine. Let's talk about the two of you. And also, and he was like, you know, the therapist was like, Here's
Does
the
that
thing.
Seem familiar to you? Like, you know, exactly. The kid can leave.
That's exactly
Let's talk
right.
to you.
You and you, you stay after school.
Yeah.
Because the deal is, that he was explaining to me was, I watched your dynamic, and you know, and my husband had not come to this first session, right?
Yeah.
But he was like, I watched your dynamic with him. I've watched it for two sessions, and it's what's cool is you have this super correctable problem, which is that you give him so much agency. You respect him. It's clear you respect this person and the person that he is. I can't make people have respect, intrinsic respect for their kid if they don't have that. However, he takes up like this much space in the household in terms of like where his like feelings matter.
Yeah.
And he needs to take up this much space. Like we got to right size the influence that he has on your own emotions and decisions. Because that will feel out of whack to a child. They'll think they want to, you know, have this much say.
Yeah.
But really, it's truly unsettling for children to have that much say.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he's like, and it's really easy to have happen in, like, you know, kind of nerdy, nerdy families and also one kid.
Yeah.
But it was cool to, like, realize that he's, like, the most important, you know, relationship that's going to happen in that house is your and your husband's, the one that you have together.
Yeah.
That is the, like, that, you know, they want to, you know, kids just, that's where kids, like, structure and stability comes from.
That's the model.
Yeah. And, like, you know, and I would imagine that when a marriage is no longer a possible thing in the household.
Yeah.
That it's still about the parent being at ease and cool with the decisions being made. Do you know what I mean? And
like, totally.
It's like, you know, like it might not even be the decisions I would make, but I'm cool that you're cool with it. You know? So it makes a ton of sense to me that was the way your kids received that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really was. I was pretty sure that's how it was going to go because of the way we've been able to, you know, work with the changing dynamic over the course of the years. And just, I mean, we all, it's so funny. They told me years later that, I became a different person. Like for them to watch me become, because on the outside, when I was in my own head all the time, worried about everything, it manifested itself in me always looking sad, distant, and
cold.
Angry.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I'm over here worrying, you know, about their well-being.
Yeah.
Terrified of everything. I was scared of hurting them, dropping them, being a bad father. Am I doing this right? And I was so concerned with all of that I was taking it way too seriously. Mm. And, you know, just on the other side of the room. And not to say we didn't have, you know, times. Of course we did. But, you know, what do you remember?
Right.
You know, and that's what they remember.
Yeah.
They remember Dad used to be like this. And then he got better. And
that's so cool that they have that story.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you gave them their dad.
Yeah, thank God.
That's so great.
You know, so to... I'd be remiss if we wrap this thing up without me asking you about this, and I don't usually do this on the show because usually what happens is I do the plugs and everything afterward and everything, but I do want to ask you about Freak Train.
Okay.
Because I think that's probably one of the most unique and wonderful things here in Denver, and I just wanted to ask you a little about the genesis of that and where it came from, and, you know, tell the people who don't know about it what it is.
so it's a monthly show at the Bug Theater in Northwest Denver, and it it originated because two theater companies at the time that no longer exist in Denver, the Bug Theater Company, which was the resident theater company at the Bug at the time, and Promethean Theater Company, they wanted to collaborate on something to do on Monday, on a Monday night that's a dark night in the theater. So
yeah.
That's, and they were like, you know, thinking about what to do. And one of the company members had spent some time in, I think it was Louisville. And there was something around that town called Freak. I think maybe it was called Freak Train, but it was spelled with a PH. No. Maybe, yeah, I can't, now I can't remember. It was Freak something, and it had this sort of like anything goes quality to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was like, what if we did something like that, you know? And so it debuted in August of 2000, and there were probably 30 of us there. And, you know, we all just, you know, got up for 5 minutes. That, you know, the format's been the same. It's 12 slots of 5 minutes each. And, you know, you perform whatever comes, whatever you'd like, right? So it could be, you know, it could be some improv, or it could be some monologue that you've been working on, or, you know, if you're a singer-songwriter, you know, it's just, it's an open mic, but it's an open stage because it's at a theater and you do have your run of the stage if you want it.
Yeah.
You do have to contend with whatever set might be occupying the stage as well at the time. And so sometimes there'll be some rules about what you can or cannot touch or get on. but over time, it sort of became, I think what we keyed into is that, you know, open mics usually, you know, whether singer-songwriter or comedy in nature, it's, you know, like it's about being good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
and Freak Train's not about being good at right. The thing that you're doing. Now, we have been completely regaled by virtuosos over our nearly 20 years, right? Like, so it's not that we don't have amazing talent that shows up at Freak Train. It's just that that's not the point of design for it.
Yeah.
And
there's not a barrier to entry for people.
Not at all. We talk about the bar being at an extremely attainable level.
All you got to do is show up
on
time.
You just have to show up and sign up.
Yeah.
And, so it's not a curated night of talent. No one promises talent of any kind. I think what that does is it creates a community around that evening that is, in addition with the free beer that comes with your admission, there's just this, like, whatever happens, happens. And people have shared really personal things about themselves on the Freak Train stage, or really personal art. Mm-hmm. We've been, you know, quote unquote, shock valued for sure.
Yeah.
We as the audience, we know what's happening when it's happening. You know, we know when we're seeing something really, really, truly good. And yeah. We also know when we're seeing someone just trying something out, taking it for a spin, or someone who's, you know, shown up time and again with kind of the same crap. And you're like, oh, you know, I wish for you a little more awareness that, you know, at this point, it's time to arc a little bit.
Yeah.
Either don't keep doing that or try something new maybe be done. But I think part of what makes Freak Train really special is that we don't pinch off the little weird branches that try to grow on this crazy little tree. And, you know,
yeah.
So it just, you know, it's not coiffed, it's not curated, it's you know, and sometimes it gets a little over comic, you know, like gets a little over stand-up.
Yeah.
And even the stand-ups feel it. And they're like, fuck, it was too many stand-ups tonight. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And it's like, so which one of you is going to not do it? You yeah, know what I mean? Like, yeah, which yeah. one of you is going to give up your slot? Oh, not me.
Yeah.
But you go with it. And this audience has over time really been, I think, you know, sort of cultivated to just enjoy human people, you know, enjoy yeah. someone ready to put themselves out there. Enjoy it for what you can enjoy about it,
yeah.
which I think in a time like now, we need more than anything.
Yes, completely. Yeah, it is one of my absolute favorite things to go watch and especially be a part of. I love it to death, and I love you to death for coming and doing this today.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for talking to me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's been really special.
It has indeed been really special. This whole podcast has been really special. This is probably the thing that I've done with my life that I'm the most proud of as far as creative output goes. And guess what? I'm looking at new ways to bring this to you. That's right. I'm trying to get out in the world and do some live shows. Especially since the one-year anniversary of this very show is coming up in July. And I couldn't do it without people like you. Thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for listening to the show. Thanks for rating and subscribing on iTunes. Those numbers really matter more than you think. So until next week, my friends, don't kill yourselves out there.